Hey, y'all, how's it going? How's things? How's your life? Oh, good. Appreciate y'all tuning in. I'm just turning on Fox. Oh, that's not even the right channel. Yeah, I'm just turning on the news. I hope nothing too big is on fire that I missed. All right, I guess they'll let us know. Well, no, not necessarily. They might let us know. I need, like, you know, a lot of radio stations, they'll have four TVs with four major news channels going. That'd be cool. You know, just for when there's breaking news. Anyway, got a good show lined up for you today. Did I introduce myself? I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm here on the Liberty Radio Network from noon to 2 Eastern Time on the weekdays, and I do anti-war radio on Sunday morning on KPFK, although I'm skipping again this week because of their fund drive. They're just going to devote that time to asking for money. But that's cool. Most Sunday mornings I'm there. KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, even though I live in Austin, Texas again, where I'm from. And I don't know, I'm not on the masthead or whatever the hell anymore, but I'm the opinion editor at antiwar.com, I guess. Something. I'm laid off, but I still work there. That's what I am. I'm laid off, but I still work there at antiwar.com. It's an important project. They need the help. I'm qualified. So, that's antiwar.com. And speaking of fund drives, the reason I'm laid off, because they don't have any money. But it's their fund drive right now. So maybe if you help donate a lot of money to them, they could give me my job back and then I'd have health insurance. Oh my God. You know, Humana just raised my health insurance by, $50, 40, 47 bucks in a month. Anyway, don't you hate them? Me too. All right. So that's who I am. ScottHorton.org is my website. It's, there's 3,500 interviews going back to 2003 there. You find all my articles I wrote and a bunch of documentaries that I did not make but I would like for you to see. And you can find a button there also to support the show. Somebody sent me half a Bitcoin yesterday. Yeah, well, half a Bitcoin right now is worth a little bit more than $100, which means that the guy that sent me half a Bitcoin is getting a QR code commodity disc in the mail. Because anybody who donates $100 or more to the show gets a QR code commodity disc in the mail. CommodityDiscs.com, Facebook.com/CommodityDiscs. It's a 1 ounce silver round. It doesn't have a face value on it. It has a QR code on the back side, on the tail side. You just scan the QR code with your phone and you get the real-time market price of an ounce of silver. It's the solution to all quandaries of currencies in world history. There you go. It's the perfect currency. It's the perfect currency. CommodityDiscs.com, and you get one if you donate $100 or more, half a Bitcoin or more, at today's market prices. Yeah. That's at scotthorton.org/support. Yeah. Okay. Now, more housekeeping. Today on the show, I got four guests in a two-hour show. I got Mark Hyden coming up here in just a minute. He's from Conservatives Concerned About the Death Penalty. Well, I'm a libertarian, and I'm concerned, too. And I admit, I'm torn. I read true crime stories sometimes, and I think, well, give me the brick, and I'll bash the guy's skull in, and then he'll be good and dead, and that'll be his just punishment for the horrible crime he did. It's almost always a he. There are some true crime stories, things that people do to each other, that they do to their stepchildren, et cetera, that are just, I want to bash their skulls in. I'm a human male, so I have a sense of ultimate justice. But I don't trust the state. I don't trust any judge in this entire land. I don't trust any prosecutor or any juror to decide correctly, really, to even put someone in prison, much less to take their life. And I don't believe in giving some prison guards and doctors the authority to murder people. even though there are certainly some people who be nice if somebody threw him off the top of something, you know? I don't know. But no, government is worse than private criminality. And empowering them with the with life and death over the rest of us, bad move. Bad move. That's Ron Paul's one big flip-flop. Yeah, he used to be for the death penalty, and then I decide I just can't support this system anymore. And it's so racist, you know. Go look at the percentage of first-degree murders and the percentage that go to death row and what color they are. It's as obvious as you might guess. And, of course, it's about money, but race and class are intertwined in America pretty severely, as you well know. So, anyway, conservatives concerned about the death penalty, me too. So Mark Hyden's going to be on the show to talk about that. Then our friend Eric Margolies is going to be on the show. And I think I'm going to ask him about Yemen and Ukraine. Ukraine and Yemen. I don't know why, but I can't seem to get this guy Gregory Johnson on the show. I sure would like to interview him about Yemen. He writes a lot of great stuff. But anyway, Eric Margolies knows a hell of a lot, too. I don't know any other... Anybody got recommendations for good people to interview about Yemen? Let me know. But Eric's going to be on... And very important Ukraine news to cover as well, of course. And then Gareth Porter's going to be on to talk about the... oh, and I skipped Yosef Butt. Boy, I better not forget that. I get so distracted sometimes. Yosef Butt is going to be on here in just a few minutes to debunk David Sanger's latest war propaganda in the New York Times against Iran. Gareth could do that, but he's going to be on some different war propaganda against Iran. Following up on the murder of, what's his name, Nisman. What was his first name again? Alberto. I thought it was Alberto. I should have just guessed and guessed correctly. Alberto Nisman, prosecutor in Argentina who's been murdered. Oh, and it's all wrapped up in accusations against Iran and Hezbollah and terrorism and this and that. And so Gareth Porter will be on to talk about that. So there you go. Mark Hyden, Yosef Butt, Eric Margolies, Gareth Porter coming up on the show today. Ain't that great? Okay, good. Now I have a couple of minutes to get a little bit of news out of the way for you. I still haven't had time to watch the Jeb Bush address. I actually, before everything came together, I was going to spend the first hour of the show today playing the Jeb Bush foreign policy speech and mocking and ridiculing it, but we just don't have time for it today, but you can find it online. It's at the Chicago Council of Global Affairs, which is the Council on Foreign Relations, Chicago Division. I don't know why they renamed it, but whatever. But all the reviews are in, and the reviews are that Jeb Bush sucks, that he's an idiot, that he doesn't know what he's talking about. He said Iraq when he meant Iran. He seemed like he didn't even mean to be that. He didn't even want to be there. He said that ISIS had 200,000 troops. Now, I know Patrick Coburn gives us a pretty high estimate. Probably the highest estimate I've heard is from him, 100,000. And he admits he's just guessing, kind of, you know, but it's an educated guess. 100,000. But all the official estimates are that they have 20,000 fighters. 20,000 fighters. So that's the CIA's official estimate. You know Jeb Bush ain't reading Coburn. He didn't double it. He multiplied it by 10. Because, hey, what's a decimal point to a bush? And the entire speech roundly panned. Here's this guy who's got to pretend, as he said, I'm my own man. When, no, you're not. You're George W. Bush's little brother. You're George W. Bush's little brother. And you're never going to not be. And then anyway, all he had to say was a bunch of, you know, platitudes and bromides and the exact same crap that you'd hear from any cookie cutter Republican. Nothing unique, nothing I'm my own man about him whatsoever. He's even got Paul Wolfowitz as one of his top advisors. Oh, and so much news I didn't get to. Later. Sooner. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy.
Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And first up today is Mark Hyden from Conservatives Concerned About the Death Penalty. The website is conservativesconcerned.org. Welcome back to the show, Mark. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Scott. Thanks for having me back on.
Well, good. I'm very happy to have you here, and I really support the work you guys are doing. I think it's really important, and especially on law and order issues, does hardly any good for bleeding heart liberals and libertarians to wail and cry about injustice. But when conservatives can attack the right from the right and say, hey, if we want real law and order, we need to, you know, roll back these things that are getting out of control, that kind of thing, that can be very powerful. It can make such a big difference. So, you know, oneconservativesconcern.org is worth 100 liberal or libertarian concerned about the death penalty type sites or movements, I'm afraid to say. But at the same time, you know, I think it's great what you guys are doing for that reason. So tell me, what is it about the death penalty that's got you and your compadres here at Conservatives concerned about the death penalty, so concerned that you're willing to put aside the, you know, at least typical, I don't want to assume too much about your prior beliefs or whatever, but the typical conservative support for the death penalty as the ultimate in law and order for some of the absolutely heinous crimes committed by people in this country?
Well, I think any time that we're able to work together, whether it's the left and the right or libertarians and conservatives working together, that we should try to. But this is an issue that can bring us all together, even in this age of when bipartisanship is so taboo. But when you look at the death penalty, the way it's run today, it runs contrary to many of our foundational principles. It risks innocent life. And we know this because there's been so many wrongful convictions and so many people that have been executed when there was serious doubt regarding the veracity of their verdict. And then it's more costly than life without parole. It's even led to tax increases. So it's not fiscally responsible. And Scott, I got to tell you, I don't find anything limited about giving an error-prone state the power to kill its citizens. So it's not limited to government. And then we find out that it doesn't deter murder, and it even harms murder victims' family members. And I've been told over and over again that capital punishment is there for the murder victims' family members. But even they are speaking out against it now.
All right. And so now for my own personal thing, and I think this represents, you know, as you mentioned, too, it's really just the question of reliability. We have an adversarial system, although, you know, it's been – there are so many precedents set now about what's admissible and not admissible, even as far as defenses that people are allowed to put on. I think just that kind of basic premise is in question really now. But even if it's not, even if we live in a kind of Matlockian system where it works the way it's supposed to, you better have Matlock on your side or you might just go to prison. Right. So mistakes are made no matter what. When the system is working perfectly, mistakes still get made, that kind of thing. And that's such an important thing for people to understand that, you know, hey, he was convicted doesn't necessarily mean he was guilty. It means he's considered guilty under the law, kind of thing. But, you know, for me, people mostly still get the benefit of the doubt until I hear the details of the case myself. It seems like I think people more and more feel that way, that the system just can't be trusted, especially like you say, with a final verdict like this. If somebody's in prison for 40 years, if they don't die in there, they can still eventually get out. I read about some people who got out of prison after false convictions today, but if they're dead, they can't. That's just it's just given it's setting us up for the kind of mistakes that cannot be fixed.
Even though
we all agree, I think, you know, so many of us anyway agree in this country that some criminals do deserve to die. It's just there. It's a separate question of whether we're going to allow our governments to do the killing or anybody else.
Yeah, you're right, Scott. And actually, I was talking to the Georgia Tea Party last night in Marietta, Georgia. They had me come in as a speaker. And a lot of the minds were changed once I told them how dangerous this program was, how many mistakes are made, and how oftentimes there's actually a prosecutorial misconduct leading to wrongful convictions. So a lot of people changed their minds on the spot. But I did have a couple that were struggling. And they said, we really need to have this death penalty for the most heinous of murders. So I had to remind them that the death penalty, the way it's run, it doesn't execute the most heinous of murders. That's just not how it works. But if you do want a system that executes the worst of the worst, you have to have a broader system in place. And if you believe that governments and humans are fallible, you have to be willing to accept a certain amount of collateral damage. So I'd ask them how many innocent lives are they willing to execute to get the real bad guys. And, of course, they couldn't give me an answer on that.
Right. Well, and you know, it's frustrating too when some of these stories, there's just no question. The guy's caught completely red-handed. He admits it. Everybody knows he did it. There's 100 witnesses, whatever, whatever. Some of these really are beyond a shadow of a doubt. And yet, that's not a separate standard. It's simply beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's in the minds of 12 random you-don't-know-whos and under the impression that they're left with under the process, the way it's set up. So that is a far cry from, you know, we all agree beyond a shadow of a doubt kind of situation.
Yeah, that's correct. And actually, if you want to look and see who actually receives the death penalty, it's based on location. It's based on what county you're in, because most counties don't use the death penalty. They can't even afford to use it. And then you have to look at whether or not what kind of a defense attorney that the accused receives, because oftentimes they get really bad attorneys. Some of them in the past weren't even criminal defense attorneys. I can think of one example where he was an insurance attorney. So oftentimes it's poor representation that leads to this. But one of the things that you can point at, if you look at the race of the victim, that's often a good indicator of whether or not they're going to seek the death penalty or not.
Oh, yeah, and probably especially when it's cross-referenced with the race of the perpetrator, as in black-on-white murders get the death penalty more than any other one.
Certainly.
Right. All right, so now, tell us quickly, what are you doing about it, Mark?
You know, I'm traveling the United States. I'm going to conservative groups. I'm going to libertarian groups, tea parties, colleges, and all sorts of conferences. And I'm just trying to educate people. Whether or not you support the death penalty in theory or biblically, our government doesn't run the program well, or up to theoretical, or up to biblical standards. And if we really are skeptical about government power, then we have to be willing to look at this program, because I don't believe there's a bigger government power than one that can take your life away. So this is a program we need to revisit. We're changing hearts and minds one at a time. And I'm very positive in my outlook. I know that Republican support for capital punishment actually had a 5-point swing in a single year. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to think that we were part of that. But that's the largest swing. That was larger than the past 19 years combined. So
wow.
Minds are starting to change, and support for capital punishment is near a 40-year low. And I think capital punishment is slowly becoming obsolete here in the United States as more people learn about how dangerous and wasteful this program is.
Awesome. And now you're doing CPAC here real quick, real soon. I know that. And are you trying to get these other groups to come out as groups in favor of your position here?
Well, I'd be happy to see more groups come out against the death penalty, and we've formed a strategic partnership with the Young Americans for Liberty and Jeff Frazee, their leaders against mm-hmm. capital punishment. He's one of our supporters. The Liberty Coalition, also we formed a partnership with them and their leaders, Michael Osterlink, who's also a supporter of ours and came out against the death penalty. So I'd be happy to work with many other organizations that are already out in criminal justice reform and hopefully get them to stand up and talk about a broken government program that we need to get rid of.
You should talk with Grover Norquist and bring him on as a deficit hawk on this, as a fiscal hawk. And how just the death penalty racket and how much money is wasted and all the extra appeals and all the extra process and all that. I bet you that might be a good avenue to try to go down.
Oh, you bet. And, you know, I've met with him before and talked with some of his supporters, and there's no shortage of examples of the death penalty causing horrible budget decisions, leading to tax increases, and even leading municipalities to mortgage all of their ambulances in order to try to execute someone. So this is a conversation we can have.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. It's heroic work. Thank you so much for coming back on the show. I appreciate it, Mark.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, y'all, that's Mark Hyden. He's at conservativesconcerned.org. That's conservatives concerned about the death penalty. We'll be right back. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Next up is Yosef Butt, Dr. Yosef Butt. He is a nuclear physicist and senior scientific advisor at the British American Security Information Council, BASIC, based in London. Welcome back to the show, Yosef. How you doing, man?
Good, Scott. How are you?
Real good. Good to talk to you again. I open my email this morning and there's you saying, I object. And then I open up my Twitter and there's everyone saying, oh no, look, David Sanger is making accusations about Iran's nuclear program in the New York Times. Whatever shall we make of this? And I thought, oh, we better hear from Yosef Butt about this. Someone more than qualified, to put David Sanger and William J. Broad's New York Times writing into perspective. So their headline reads, inspectors say Iran is evading questions as nuclear talks enter a crucial stage. Oh, my God. Is Barack Obama negotiating with terrorists who are dishonestly hiding a nuclear weapons program right in the middle of negotiating a further inspection regime? Sanctions relief in order to prevent just that very eventuality, Yosef?
Yeah, well, you know, the timings of these reports are always interesting. They always seem to come on very crucial times in the talks. My main objection to the New York Times piece is just that it's one-sided. So, you know, they basically say, here's all the stuff that the IAEA is saying. But, you know, let's just print that and let's not hear from the many experts who have criticized the IAEA's work on Iran. They're taking this approach that, you know, we're just here to report what the IAEA says. We're not here to actually investigate or, like, educate the public on whether any of this is actually true or might be suspect. So there's actually grave concerns about some of these accusations, and that's all they are. They're accusations. They're unauthenticated allegations against Iran's nuclear program. Even former IAEA director Hans Blix, said there's as much information as disinformation. That's a quote from him about these allegations. And El Baradei, who was the head of the IAEA for 12 years or so, said in his latest memoirs that, quote, no one knew if any of this was real. So, you know, why is the New York Times printing this as if it's something to be concerned about?
Well, at least they have, Broad and Sanger have dropped the phrase illicit nuclear weapons program from their reporting, where it used to just be taken as a given that everyone knows that Iran has an illicit nuclear weapons program. Now, they never apologized or said, I guess we have to now refute the last 100 of our articles that we wrote together here. But at least, you know, they, for the most part, have backed off of that. But then I'm trying to find the paragraph here. I could have swore it was right toward the beginning where one of the accusations is about some tests that were going on in Western Iran, where I know I've read Gareth Porter saying that the Iranians invited the IAEA to go out there and to inspect the site, and they refused to do so.
It's actually very clear. It's paragraph 43 of the IAEA's 2011 reports annex, which is the annex and where all these possible military dimensions, which were formerly known as the alleged studies file, are. So paragraph 43 says basically there were large-scale, high-explosive experiments. There were hemispherical explosives. There were fiber-optic cables, street cameras, et cetera, very worrying stuff, if it's real, and that this was done in Marivan, a site in western Iran. And, yeah, so the Iran says, why don't you come and check this out and, you know, let's put these allegations behind us. And then the IAEA's response is, well, you know, we're not really interested. So, you know, it appears to be just rumor, you know, just rumors that they're not even willing to investigate. So what's the point of publishing them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, then they turn around and complain that Iran is not cooperating. We still have all these unanswered questions when they refuse to accept an invitation to come and get their question answered. And that's ridiculous.
And to be honest, they're serious allegations. So, you know, if this happened, we need to know. I mean, I don't know what's real and what's not in the alleged studies document because they're allegations. Some of them, as Blick says, there's as much information as disinformation. So some of it could be real. And this is very serious from a non-proliferation standpoint. The IAEA needs to go and check this out if what they're saying is real. So, you know, either withdraw your allegations or go check it out when you're invited to do so. Like, you know, it's just logically inconsistent. Mm-hmm. They just seem to want to perpetuate a rumor and not even investigate it.
Right. Well, and the whole thing is it smacks of false accusation as my friend Gordon Prather, former nuclear weapons scientist, says, and this is something that never is written into the context of any of this stuff, is that, you know, look, for the Iranians, never even mind having some weapons-grade uranium or some weapons-grade plutonium ready to go, for them to make a nuclear bomb out of it would require for them to have a Sandia National Laboratory of their own, basically, a huge nuclear weapons infrastructure to create it. And they just don't have anything like that. And so, okay, yeah, you know, testing some implosion systems out at Marivan in the desert, it sounds sort of plausible if you accept the given that somewhere they have a giant Sandia National Laboratory hidden underground somewhere, and this is part of that. But otherwise, it doesn't make any sense for them to be testing these implosion systems out there in the desert when it doesn't correlate with any other true fact that anybody knows.
Yeah, well, yeah, in any case, most of these allegations are from more than a decade ago. So, you know, it's even if true, it's not clear that any of it is of current concern. The other thing that, you know, instead of worrying about Marivan, where they make very serious accusations, they seem to be much more interested in the Parchin military complex, where the IAEA has already visited twice and found nothing. And, you know, Robert Kelly was a former IAEA inspections director and weapons scientist in the U.S. weapons complex has criticized the Parchin obsession also because, you know, he says there's supposed to be some large chamber that they're supposed to have done explosions in over there. And it doesn't make any sense because, you know, you could still pick up residues of any radioactivity that any tests that were done with uranium in there. And so the timing is off. The site is located very close to a fence, 200 meters from the boundary, whereas it's a huge, Parchin is huge. If they wanted to do something very hidden, they could do it deep inside Parchin. Why make it 200 meters from a fence? So the whole thing, you know, it just doesn't ring true. They also say that the Parchin chamber was supposed to be being designed in 2000, and then they say that it was being tested in 2000. So the timeline doesn't also hang together. There's just a lot of questions about this, and where they make the serious accusations in Marivan, they don't seem to want to go. Where they've already been twice and found nothing, they seem to want to go again. So it's just, you know, who knows what the IAEA is doing. My own problem with them is they don't really know about nuclear weapons. They are people who do nuclear materials accountancy. You know, how much went in, how much came out, they're very good with that. and picking up trace amounts of radioactivity. They're good in those tasks, but they don't know about nuclear weapons, and they're getting confused, mm-hmm. and they need outside help.
Yeah, and here they are with a mandate from the UN to try to pester the Iranians into letting them inspect their missile facilities and their centrifuge manufacturing facilities and all these other things outside their purview. Now, I'm sorry, we got to take this break, but we'll be right back, everybody, with Yosef Butt, nuclear physicist and senior scientific advisor at BASIC in London. We're talking about Broad and Sanger in the Times today.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Dr. Yosef Butt, nuclear physicist and senior scientific advisor at the British American Security Information Council, BASIC, based in London. And we're talking about Broad and Sanger in the New York Times, waxing scary about the possible military dimensions to Iran's nuclear program. The alleged studies. I was just thinking during the break there, Yosef, that whoever forged the alleged studies, the so-called smoking laptop, they must have won one heavy gold medal from the Israeli Mossad that almost definitely contracted them to do so, because this has just been the most useful piece of, albeit completely debunked, dis and misinformation on this subject. Has done more to throw a wrench in, you know, I don't know exactly the role it's played in the negotiations, but certainly in getting a honest narrative across to the American people about what actually is even being negotiated here. There's so much smoke. There must be some fire. People are led to believe. And this so-called smoking laptop, these alleged studies, they cover, you know, I don't know what, 6 or 10 different points that can be brought up over and over and over again separately from each other. You can rename them possible military dimensions. So now it's a whole new group of the same debunked accusations again and again. Here, Broad and Sanger are bringing up missile payloads. Well, even David Albright debunked Broad and Sanger in the New York Times about the missile payloads part of the alleged studies documents back, geez, I don't know, 7 years ago or something, where, as Gareth Porter has elaborated, it's the wrong rocket in the forgery. They were already developing a newer, better rocket than the one that the forgery claims that they were developing a warhead for or a delivery vehicle for. And yet here they are in February 2015 pretending that this is a possible military dimension when they've already had to concede this point in the past.
Yeah, well, you know, my concern with it is, you know, I'd like to stick to the specifics. So, you know, the issue is that this is not something that the IAEA is outfitted to investigate. They don't know about ballistic missiles and payloads. And, yeah, they can call in people, but what you really need is similar to what was in Iraq, an action team with outside experts who know about this stuff, who can go in and say, well, you know, this seems real, this is not real, not just people who are not really skilled in this matter, don't know about missiles, trying to evaluate missiles and then getting things wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned the possible military dimensions. You know, I don't know what all is in there. There well could be some things that are correct, but there certainly seem to be things that are wrong. For instance, in Sanger and Broad's piece, today or yesterday, they mentioned the neutron transport studies. This relates to paragraph 52 in the annex report from 2011. And basically, we linked this to the leaked Associated Press graphs, which were incorrect and very shoddy. basically having a wrong time scale did not correspond to any realistic nuclear explosions, and a wrong energy power correspondence also in those graphs. So there's a lot of about, you know, you can say neutron studies and scare people, but it seems to correspond to things that are very suspect that have been leaked to the press. Mm-hmm. And it's not just my opinion. There was another nuclear physicist at the Monterey Institute, Ferenc Delnoky-Varez, and we both studied this, and other people have also weighed in and corroborated that. Mm-hmm. So this, you know, and even, let's say, even if this was true, computer studies like that actually, as long as they don't involve physical nuclear material, are actually allowed under the NPT. Now, you can criticize the NPT, but they actually do allow it, and so does the IAEA regulation mm-hmm. that Iran has signed on to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot of smoke here, and it's hard to, you know, get to see any fire there.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, let me ask you about one more of those details there. There's part of the alleged studies is that one of the accusations is that they at least had plans for some bench level experiments with lasers, with laser enrichment to create uranium tetrafluoride, so-called green salt. And my understanding was that even though the accusation is only bench level experiments anyway or whatever, that actually made no sense whatsoever because they already had the uranium conversion facility at Isfahan, where they can convert uranium to uranium hexafluoride gas, which is what they need for the centrifuges, and that there is no other need for the green salt. So it seemed like the kind of thing that was made to look like they were guilty of something, that they were hiding something, but really it made no sense once the truth came out that they already knew how to make hexafluoride gas.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. Obviously, it might have been a pilot project. It might have been a research level project. I don't know. But the point is, as long as they're not actually diverting their nuclear material to a military program, it's none of the IAEA's business. Now you can.
Well, but I guess I'm sorry, Yosef. My very poorly phrased question was about whether green salt is good for anything or anything. Does it make any sense that they would be that they would need green salt?
To me, it personally does not make sense. But it may make sense for people to do research. There's research level projects in all sorts of things. But I think the overall point again is that as long as material is not diverted to military uses, it's not officially a problem. So even centrifuges, unless somebody knows that they are using this for a military purpose, centrifuges are perfectly allowed. As many as Iran wants is technically allowed. Now you can argue with how lax those regulations are, but that's the bottom line. So There may have been various research projects that perhaps made sense or didn't make sense. I don't know, but you know, sticking to the things that were mentioned in the New York Times report, none of those things make much sense, and none of those things is worth holding up a nuclear agreement with Iran that could tamp down future threats. I mean, instead of obsessing over stuff that's 10 years old and probably incorrect, and probably not even a violation of the safeguards agreement, why not make a deal with Iran that improves the future?
Mm-hmm. All right. And now back to your thesis about we really need a different kind of organization to do this. That's because what the Iranians are accused of obstructing are not investigations mandated by the safeguards agreement with the IAEA. They're separate investigations mandated by the UN Security Council and given to the IAEA, but they might as well have given the task to the local sheriff's department or somebody else. It's really outside of the purview of the IAEA's actual role under the NPT, correct?
Yeah, that's pretty much correct. So, yeah, they might be a little bit more competent than the local sheriff's department, but probably not much. So,
but they're not
created
for this task any more than the local sheriff's department is.
Exactly. So, you know, they don't know. They do have some staff that knows about nuclear weapons, but also there's an issue that member states can actually ban nationalities of various inspectors. So they, as far as I know from information from the inside, that they have banned various inspectors. And Robert Kelly and Tarek Ralph had a piece in Arms Control Today where they mentioned, you know, pretty much all the Western inspectors from all the Western states are banned from working on Iran's file. And those would be some of the few people who would have nuclear weapons knowledge. So, you know, and the structure and the organization and the bureaucracy there is just not designed to look into nuclear weapons accusations. So what's really needed is an action team with outside experts who come from, who have this knowledge, who can evaluate the evidence and say what's real and what's not, instead of just perpetuating these rumors and, you know, New York Times picking it up and making it sound like it's a big deal and it's not.
Right. Well, yeah, and especially these two, they're expert at that. And in fact, whenever there's a big piece in the New York Times going the other way, it's always by James Risen or somebody else. Like when they are reporting that the CIA still says that they haven't decided to even begin trying to make nuclear weapons. You'll never see a Sanger byline on that one. So very important to keep in mind who's who over there. Thanks very much for your time and your great work on this subject, Yosef.
Thank you. You're welcome.
All right, we'll be right back, y'all. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back. Oh, headphones. All right, you guys, welcome back. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. I got Eric Margulies on the line. Hey, Eric, how are you?
I'm just fine, Scott. We're bursting full of news.
Yeah, there's a ton going on. First, let me tell him who you are. He's a reporter. He's a journalist, spent decades and decades reporting on war after war after war, 14 of them, right?
That's right.
Yeah, 14 wars. He wrote War at the Top of the World about Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Kashmir problems, and all that area there. And then American Raj, Liberation or Domination, about the American World Empire, but of course, focused on the Middle East mostly there. And his website is ericmargulies.com. Spell it like Margolis, ericmargulies.com. You can find all his articles there. He also writes at lewrockwell.com and for UNZ.com. That's UNZ, UNZ.com. All right. So, yes, lots and lots of news. I think we should start with Ukraine, unless you know something that's even more important than that.
No, there's nothing that's more important than Ukraine right now, because if this foolish and unnecessary conflict gets out of hand, we could be facing a direct clash with Russia that could lead to a nuclear exchange. So let's start with that.
All right. Well, that's too horrible to imagine, so it must be impossible.
Well, you know, we're going through the 100th anniversary of World War I, where we saw ostensibly bright, intelligent, responsible people just tumbling into a war that was not necessary either. They all thought for the best of reasons, but as we look back now, it's incredible stupidity. And as we look at events in Ukraine, we think it's reckless behavior by the Western powers, by NATO particularly, and by the neocon cabal in Washington.
All right. So take us back then, as long as you're going to make such sweeping statements, rewind a couple of years or however long you think you need to give people a good context for the current crisis. And in your last article, I should mention here, is the most optimistic thing I've read by you in quite some time. It's celebratory on behalf of the new peace deal.
Well, yes, I may have been premature with that. I don't know. Time will tell. I was very happy to see a ceasefire in Ukraine, which I've been advocating, And I've been beating the war drums now for over a year on the dangers of war in Ukraine. I don't think people really understand what kind of trouble they were getting into. Look, 2 years ago, well, in 1991, Ukraine, which had been part of the Soviet Union for hundreds of years, broke away, declared its independence as the Soviet Union was collapsing, and the West rushed in to provide aid to Ukraine on the premise that the best way to undermine Soviet slash Russian power is to chop away its contingent parts, the biggest and most important one being Ukraine, because it had heavy industry, seaports, and nuclear weapons. Thank God the nuclear weapons were eventually handed over to the West. Otherwise, we'd have today the Ukrainians and the Russians rattling their nuclear sabers at each other.
Boy, I got that right. All right, but then so fast forward to some Bush and Obama years for us and you know, explain what the current crisis is
yes.
about here.
So Ukraine has emerged as a completely failed state. It was its businesses, its economy were run by gangsters and oligarchs, total criminal society. Everything was done with bribes and intimidation. It was a mess. But as I said, the West saw an opportunity there, which it couldn't turn away from, to boost up Ukraine as an independent country. So Western aid poured into Ukraine. A secret American help allowed a leader to be elected, Yushchenko, who was very pro-Western, then Yulia Tymoshenko, and so on. The point was that they couldn't establish a stable government in Kiev. An election was held. A pro-Russian candidate was elected in a completely fair vote. He was a big turkey, too, corrupt and self-enriching, Yanukovych. But he had the backing of the Russians, and he was about to sign an important trade deal with the Russians when agitation in Western Ukraine, they wanted the Western Ukrainians wanted to be part of Europe and NATO and aligned with the United States. The Eastern Ukrainians who speak Russian wanted to align themselves with Russia. So here you have the basis of a civil war, and just to come to the end of this rapidly, the U.S. and some of its NATO allies, but particularly the U.S., poured tens of millions of dollars into staging a coup in Kiev against the unpopular pro-Russian government. There was killing and fighting. It was just a year ago. And they finally, the pro-Russian leader fled to Russia, unlamented, and a pro European government took over, which the Russians immediately accused of being dominated by Nazi elements. Well, they weren't Nazis, but they were extreme hardline right-wingers who hated the Russians. So here you have the recipe where Europe's real interest, excuse me, was pushing NATO bases into Ukraine, i.e. right next door to Russia, and getting control of the Crimea, with its hugely strategic naval base of Sevastopol.
Yeah, and now, so when Putin said, hey, I'm taking Crimea because I'm not even going to chance the Americans and NATO turning Sevastopol into a NATO base, was that a legitimate concern of his, that America really meant to bring Ukraine not just into the EU, but into NATO and meant to take over that base and kick the Russians right out of it?
I have every reason to believe so. It would be the equivalent of the Red Chinese coming and taking Houston.
Or Long Beach, California or something.
Or Long Beach or something like that. I mean, Americans don't understand Sevastopol, but it's one of the gateways from Russia to the rest of the world, to the Middle East, to the Mediterranean. It was a hero city of the Soviet Union during World War II. hundreds of thousands of people died fighting to defend Sevastopol from the Germans and to retake it. So along with Leningrad, it was one of the major hero cities. And it means that when I was there a couple of years ago, it was mostly Russian anyway. The Russian fleet was there. Most of the people there were Russians, or many of them.
By the way, you know, the parliament asked the Russians to reabsorb them there. They held a little plebiscite. Was that whole thing a sham, like in the New Republic, or was that pretty much legit? Like you're saying, it's pretty much a Russian place anyway.
No, I think it was pretty much legit. I mistrust Russian plebiscites and things, but in fact, sure, it reflected the wishes of the people.
Yeah.
And the Russian ones, by the way, are no worse than the American-run votes in Afghanistan and Egypt and places like that.
Well, and as far as even illegal aggressive invasions go, not a shot fired. I think two shots fired in the air. Warning shots. No one killed in the takeover of Crimea. That's pretty good for evil Russian aggression that must be checked before it overwhelms us all, you know?
Well, the funny thing was that there were thousands of Russian troops based there before the independence or the union with Russia, because they were there to defend the base. And so these reports of Russian troops pouring into Crimea are not correct, because troops were there in the beginning.
Right. Okay, now we're at the music plant and got to take this break. But when we get back, we'll talk more about the Ukraine crisis with Eric Margolis. We'll cover, now we're really on a roll here. I want to cover the last year of the war and what's really happened between the East and the West, inside Ukraine and outside, and the current peace deal and probable futures and things like that. Stay tuned. It's the heroic Eric Margolis, author of War at the Top of the World and American Raj. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Eric Margolis, author of American Raj, Liberation or Domination, and about 10 million articles. The latest is Putin heads off a U.S.-Russia war. About the ceasefire now. So we're talking about the history of American intervention over there in Ukraine leading up to this crisis. And we're leaving off at the break there with Russia in a oh-no-you-don't. Outright season Crimea in order to keep it out of the hands of the Kiev coup d'etat junta that America put in power there. And so then what happened? That was a year ago. The coup was February 21st, 22nd of 2014. So not quite, almost a year ago. What's led to such a crisis over the last year? I mean, obviously there's a coup, but why does that have to lead to a civil war?
So we're put into power by the U.S. We know this because we have it on tape from State Department officials.
I'm sorry, Eric. You know what? I screwed up and hit the phone button instead of the Skype. So if you could please start your answer over and accept my humble begging of forgiveness.
Of course. The Ukrainian, pro-Western Ukrainian government that was put into power by the U.S. and by neocons in the State Department, we have it all on tape, were tended to be people of the right wing in Ukraine, to be naturally very anti-Russian, and to be wanting to get away from Russia as fast as possible. But they, in fact, were backed by some very unpleasant far-right groups. The Russians call them fascists or Nazis, who are determined to, who actually hark back to the 1940s, and there a terrible bitterness between the Ukrainians and the Russians. We have to remember that Stalin murdered over 6 million Ukrainians in the 1930s, and of course we can understand why Ukrainians distrust and don't like the Russians, to say the least. Anyway, you have this government in power, and they found a candy manufacturer named Poroshenko, who was made president, and they have a prime minister who is also pretty well Washington's man there. So they're moving along trying to move Ukraine into the Western orbits.
And then what? I mean, why the fighting? Well,
and then in the eastern Ukraine, pro-Russian groups, militias, volunteers started resisting. Their fighting began. First of all, the government in Kiev announced it was going to crush the rebellion. It was too big for its britches. It thought that its poorly organized army could actually crush the rebellion. It didn't. It got itself involved in a much larger war. The Russians began sending help across the border. Not much, small amounts, volunteers, very subtly. But the net result of this was that the Ukrainians, the pro-Western Ukrainians, were being defeated. And as we just saw in the last few days, this certainly was the case. And as they were being defeated, now the U.S. was secretly funding the Ukrainians, and it promised by April, which is just around the corner, that a battalion of U.S. troops would come into Ukraine, eastern Ukraine, to train supposedly Ukrainian troops and to get more involved in the war and also to deliver heavy weapons. The Republicans are beating the war drums for this. They don't want to miss a war. And the net result is that with U.S. troops coming into Ukraine, it would be like Russian troops going into Montreal. Imagine that. The Russians are not going to sit back and take this. And this is regarded in Moscow as an egregious violation of accords between Russia and the U.S. and an unwarranted intrusion of Western and U.S. forces into what's essentially Ukrainian civil war. Mm-hmm.
And now, so even though, as you said, the rebels have held their own and have, it's not like they've sacked Odessa and Kiev, but they've sure kept Kiev and their conscript forces out of the east, and they have their status quo basically. Now they have this peace deal that was hammered out between Putin, Poroshenko, Holland, and Merkel there. And now Merkel, you know, had come to the United States first and made sure to get a big public TV blessing from Barack Obama to go and do so. And so, but I wonder, you know, if does it matter that the Americans were not part of the deal? And do you think that they're trying to undermine the deal? Because, of course, it was just a week before the peace deal. You had, 70% or more of Washington, D.C. come out in favor of this Brookings report saying it's time to arm up the Ukrainian military, not so they can win, but just so they can make matters worse.
Well, unfortunately, we are as ignorant of events and geography in Ukraine as you possibly can be. And I challenge more than two or three congressmen to find Luhansk, Ukraine, on a map. But, we're irresponsible about wars in the States because they don't happen in our backyard. So it's very easy to say, oh, yeah, we'll send arms to our boys over there. And, it's because of Obama. He's weak. This is another Munich and all this baloney that we hear. Obama, at least, has been trying to be cautious. The American establishment is not. And by supplying arms and then combat troops into Ukraine, by expanding American naval operations into the Black Sea, which is Russia's underbelly, and flights over that area, we are, as we tried in Georgia a couple of years ago, we are absolutely challenging and provoking Russia. Doesn't want a war, but we are, and the Russians see this, rightly or wrongly, as our attempt to split up what's left of the Russian Federation into little feeble pieces. Mm.
So it sounds like this ceasefire is just a ceasefire. It's not a peace deal, and you think it'll be undermined sooner or later here.
I hope it will hold up. It's the only sensible solution. Over a year ago, President Putin proposed. He said the solution to the problem is federalism in Ukraine. Let the eastern provinces vote. Let them have a certain amount of autonomy, linguistic autonomy, some political autonomy, and let keep Ukraine together. Well, the West rejected this very, what I think was a sensible solution. And now Putin has stood up to the West in his backyard and is winning. But the very far right-wing Ukrainian ultra-nationalist groups are doing their best to sabotage the ceasefire. The Republicans in Washington don't really want it because we're in the midst of an anti-Putin hysteria. Can't do anything normal with the Russians now. And a lot of, American money's pouring into Ukraine, which is totally bankrupt. As fact, there's a deficit of about $40 billion. So a lot of Ukrainians are happy. As long as this crisis goes on, the greenbacks will keep coming.
Yeah, for the people close enough to the regime. So, in other words, we're kind of relying on the firmness of Angela Merkel's stand that, listen, we have to knock this off, right? But she doesn't talk that way to Barack Obama, and he doesn't really talk that way to the national security state.
No, but, you know, Europe has been very cautious from the beginning, and rightfully so, because if a war occurs, it's going to be on their territory, not ours. It's the same reason that Europe was so opposed to George Bush's attack on Iraq. They say you're going to open a Pandora's box, and who knows what's going to come flooding out, but it won't be good. Well, the same thing is happening now with Ukraine. And I would add to this, as I wrote a couple of weeks ago, wait a minute, Washington, D.C. You're going to open up a direct head-on conflict with the Russians that might go nuclear at a time when you're expanding war across the Middle East and are sure to get sucked into an endless conflict there. And number three, as you are pivoting to Asia, and this is not just rhetoric. The Pentagon is getting ready to fight a war against China, big war. And so the U.S. is waging like a three-front conflict at the same time. It is beyond foolish. It is absolutely unimaginable.
All right, y'all, that's the great Eric Margulies, ericmargulies.com, spelled like Margolis, ericmargulies.com. Thanks so much for your time again.
Thank you, Scott.
We'll be right back with Gareth Porter in just a sec, y'all. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Oh, just in the nickel of the dime, I got Gareth Porter on the line. He's an independent historian and journalist, writes primarily for Interpress Service. That's ipsnews.net. ipsnews.net. The great Jim Loeb and the gang there at Interpress Service. And then he's also done a lot of award-winning work at truthout.org. And lately he's been writing at Middle East Eye. And he's the author of the book Manufactured Crisis, the true story behind the Iranian nuclear scare. Welcome back to the show. Gareth, how are you doing? Oh, no, I can't hear you. I hit the right button this time, so it's on your end, I think. I wonder if Gareth can hear me. I think I'll start to type to him. Hi, can you hear me? See, Skype, it's such a trade-off, am I right? This happens all the time. There's some kind of problem. And when it works well, it works well. And the audio quality is so much better than a little copper landline, you know? 1930s technology and probably 50s quality. But Skype, it has its drawbacks. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. Let's see. I don't know. What am I going to do? I'm going to open up a soundbite player machine, and I'm going to play a soundbite or two. And then, while you're listening to that, I'm going to call Gareth Porter on his telephone. Oh, good. Here's Dick Cheney being interviewed by Bill Kristol. This will probably be pretty good.
One last thing about that period. I can't remember. When the decision was made to go to Congress to get the authorization to use force, which is, I recall, the decision was made in December.
Then we actually went to
Congress, and the vote was in January. Yeah. You had been in Congress. I remember there was a pretty interesting debate within the administration on that.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember. What was your view? And talk a little bit about how that decision was made, and also just lessons you learned from that in retrospect. Yeah. I mean,
there's always been a debate, certainly since the end of World War II, about the authority of the president to commit the force and so forth. And we'd had the War Powers Act adopted in the aftermath of Vietnam. My view was that we had all the authority we needed. We didn't have to go back to Congress. For example, we were party to the United Nations Charter. Article 51 provided for us to go to the aid of a fellow member of the United
Nations. Not with headphones on. I can't stand Dick Cheney talking to me from that close. I have to turn that right down. Okay, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. On the line, I have our friend Gareth Porter. Like I said in the introduction, all those things. Welcome back to the show, Gareth. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Scott. Let me just do one thing, and that is correct what is now an error about my publications. I'm no longer writing for Interpress Service.
At all?
At all. No, I don't do anything more for them. I know that's a shock.
What the hell do I know about stuff?
I should have mentioned it before, but it just, the opportunity didn't arise. So, I let it go when you mentioned it before. But, I just wanted to make that clear.
Okay, yeah, important point. Well, anyway, you still got 10 million important ones written for them, and most of those also reprinted at antiwar.com as well. So it's still important to mention for people to go back and listen.
Sure.
Yeah, okay. Well, thanks for that update. Gareth Porter, formerly with Interpress Service. All right. So we got two important articles here. One is for Middle East Eye, and the other one is for, I forgot what you told me, but let's talk about the Netanyahu leverage behind the new Iran talks flap. What in the world does all that mean?
Well, that's a reference to the flap is a reference to the situation that arose the past few days, where the Obama administration had consulted with Netanyahu government on the current plan to negotiate with Iran. This took place, if I remember correctly, the actual consultation took place in January. And as a result of the consultation, which revealed to the Israelis that the Obama administration intended to
offer a cap on the number of centrifuges at 6,500, the word, the story was leaked to an Israeli news outlet, and you know, it was made public, and the Obama administration was upset and really, you know, accused the basically accused Netanyahu and his crew of using this to interfere with U.S. policy and politics. So that was the flap. Now, the reason that I suggest that this has in fact begun to have an impact on the U.S. position in the negotiations, on the whole negotiating posture of the United States, is that, in a nutshell, what I have learned from a U.S. source who is very well informed on the Obama administration's negotiating strategy and calculus, the calculations that the Obama administration has made about these negotiations, is that the Obama administration has been deathly afraid that Congress would reject an agreement with Iran if the Obama administration's terms were not tough enough, that Congress would actually vote on an agreement and turn it down and would make it clear that this agreement could not be implemented. And if that were the case, the biggest problem that the Obama administration would have with it is not that there couldn't be an agreement, but that the United States would then be blamed by the rest of the world for the failure of the talks. Mm. And that is, you know, I think it's fair to say the biggest single consideration that the Obama administration now has with regard to these talks. They don't want to be blamed for the failure of the talks. They don't mind if they break down, apparently. What they do want to make sure does not happen is that the United States gets blamed for the failure of the talks. So that means that they have to have a position that they think is tough enough to be able to make a deal with the Republicans in the Senate, the people who, you know, basically represent the Israeli point of view, to make sure that they would not vote it down. And that's why I think the what I call the gamesmanship of the Obama administration in these negotiations, which we can go into more detail about, has actually resulted in Netanyahu having more leverage rather than less leverage on the Obama administration. I think that's a really interesting and sad irony about the present situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, so all this talk about the new sanctions seems to be obscuring what at least I thought was a fact, Gareth, that most of the sanctions, what's important about them is all the international cooperation behind them, and that the rest of the world has really only promised to cooperate with America on these sanctions, and with many glaring exceptions by our Asian allies especially, but that they've only agreed to go along with this for a limited amount of time, like while we're negotiating in good faith for a real resolution to this, and that once if the talks do break down, no matter who gets the blame for you know, how it looks, that much of the rest of the world, other than America's, you know, very closest sock puppets, are going to quit respecting the sanctions regime. And I guess now that the dang music's playing, that means that we'll have to wait and get your answer about that on the other side of it. It's Gareth Porter from Middle East Eye and author of Manufactured Crisis about Iran's civilian nuclear program. We'll be right back. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded.
Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I'm off on a tangent here from Garrett's piece, but it's something that I've been puzzling over lately and trying to get a handle on. The question at the break was, after the end of these negotiations, successful or not, much of the world's cooperation with American sanctions on Iran are set to expire anyway. Isn't that right, Gareth, or how's that work?
They're not set to expire. I think the question is, it's a political question, not sort of a legal question.
The political question is connected
with what I said before the break, which is that the United States is concerned about who's going to get blamed if the talks break down. If the United States is seen as to blame, which it would be, as I said, if Congress refuses to go along with the agreement, then that's obviously going to have an impact on a whole raft of countries that are crucial to the sanctions. So that's what they're really worried about the most. Mm-hmm.
But in there, there's got to be some number of countries that they're going to blame this on America anyway, or they're just going to say, listen, we promised to stick with this for as long as y'all's special project here, but we got business to do. We got to get by in the world here. We got to do business.
Well, I think that is a problem. I mean, I don't doubt that that's a problem. For example, India is, India is losing enormous amounts of business with Iran because of these sanctions, and they don't like it at all. I can guarantee you that. And so there is a lot of restiveness, but at the same time, I mean, these are countries that depend on the U.S. market very largely for their income, for foreign trade income and investments and so forth. So they do not have the kind of freedom to just tell the United States to thumb their nose at the United States on this, and so it's less clear cut that they would just break off. There's some nuances here with regard to different countries, but I think the point still stands that the United States is concerned about some countries that are crucial to this who would definitely break off if they saw the United States responsible for the breakdown of the talks.
Mm-hmm. Well. And then, but is there any way to spin this for Russia and China that they don't see right through it? What would the Iranians have to do for it really to be their fault for this to not work out when the whole thing's a manufactured crisis in the first place?
Well, that's a good question. Wouldn't the Russians and the Chinese see through the gamesmanship of the Obama administration? To some extent, perhaps that's true. I think that there's a lot of criticism of the position that's been taken by the United States in Russia and China, and it's possible, that the Obama administration is really deceiving itself in thinking that it could get away with, continuing the sanctions. I'm prepared to believe that. At this moment, I'm focusing more on what the perception of the Obama administration is and how that actually affects U.S. policy. But I think you're right that, that there's going to be a pretty clear perception that the United States, position in these talks was not particularly necessitated by the technical requirements of insuring against an Iranian breakout or something like that. I mean, it was a very political position taken by the United States. So I think I agree with you on that.
All right. Now, so when it comes down to the Prime Minister of Israel, he said openly he leaked the statement that he gave to the cabinet saying, I will do anything I can to ruin this deal. Not to put words in his mouth, but I think it's fair to say his position is no enrichment, no nuclear program of any description whatsoever. And
by do anything, it means leaking details that Obama's checking with him, as you say here. But it also means even coming to D.C. and basically daring Congress to side with the press of the United States over him and basically demand that they thwart the president and his ability to put this deal into practice. And I wonder, I mean, just describing it, it sounds pretty far-fetched even for the Prime Minister of Israel to really be able to get away with. I mean, I guess he's not canceling it, which I think is great, kind of, but I only think it's great because I think it's going to completely nuclear explode in his face. It's ridiculous what's happening here. So, you know, whatever leverage Obama's given him, it seems like, I don't know, what do you think is going to happen?
I think it works both ways. I mean, I think you've got two different things going on here. On one hand, it's true that, you know, he does a lot of political damage to himself by the degree of, you know, just outright boldness, you know, shamelessness in interfering in U.S. politics. That's bound to alienate a lot of people, including Democrats in the Senate, who they need the votes of. And so I think there's a built-in contradiction there. To some extent, in the Netanyahu strategy here, in some ways, you know, it's a bridge too far. I mean, it's a bit like, you know, trying to get the Congress to vote in favor of legislation that would, you know, have the United States go to war against Iran, which is not going to succeed. It's going to fail. And you know, I'm sure, you know, this is something you've talked about in your program or had discussed in your program before, that there are limits on how far the AIPAC can go in terms of pushing the U.S. Congress. It can do a lot of things. It has a lot of powers, no question about that. And I'm not saying that there's no danger to an agreement. I'm not saying that this is not a dangerous situation, but at the same time, you know, by pushing it this far, by being this outrageous, you know, to some extent, he's making it more difficult to accomplish what he wants to do.
Yeah, three cheers for that, I say. I mean, I think you're right. I think he looks like an absolute clown where... you know, even Republicans and people who personally, you know, favor Netanyahu, like him, as think he's a good leader of Israel or whatever, that still, hey, there are limits, pal, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really quite striking, quite impressive that there are, in fact, some prominent Democrats who are saying that they won't even show up, that they're going to boycott it. And Democrats in Congress, I mean, that's something new. That's never happened before. So, you know, I mean, we're in uncharted territory here.
Mm-hmm. Now, on the other hand, if this whole thing fails, with or without Netanyahu or whatever, let's say the Supreme Leader changes his mind and says, unless you lift all the sanctions immediately, we'll never deal with you, Satan, and then the whole thing falls apart. Worst case scenario, we still are left with a status quo where they've got a safeguards agreement and a signature on the nonproliferation treaty, and all of their nuclear material is verified to not have been diverted to any military or other special purpose. And so the status quo is Cold War, but not hot war. And I don't see, they'd have to make up a whole new set of lies about some nuclear weapons program going on in Iran in order to justify starting a war, to try to justify one, I mean. So it's really not that bad of a problem if the talks fail, right? Since the status quo is bad, but it's not a nightmare.
Well, I mean, you're right in an objective sense that it's absolutely true that there's no basis whatsoever for talking about war against Iran. At the same time, you know, you've got a completely false picture that's been constructed. Not just by the Israelis, but by the Obama administration itself. I mean, you know, they have started talking about as though, you know, if there's no agreement, that this is raising a very serious danger that the United States would have to do something about it. And so again, I mean, we're talking about some very difficult scenarios to try to predict. I mean, you know, it's difficult to see how that's going to play out.
I can
imagine that in the end, if there is no agreement, if the Iranians walk away from the table, as I think it's distinctly, it's not just possible, but on balance, likely, if the United States is not ready to give way, particularly on the sanctions, I think that, you know, we're bound to see the Obama administration having to review its options again and say, well, do we really want to get into a situation of threatening to do something to Iran that we don't really want to do? You know, that's something we can't totally predict at this point, that's for sure.
Right. All right, y'all, that's the great Gareth Porter. Thanks very much for your time, Gareth. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks, Scott.
All right, y'all. Again, Gareth's at MiddleEastEye.com and at Truthout. And you can find his archives also. Virtually everything he writes reprinted sooner or later at original.antiwar.com/Porter. See you tomorrow. Monday.